SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a new 3D live video journal, which is interactive with discussion, in association with SNI, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, are both pleased to present SNI Digital Interviews with Clinical Neuroscience Leaders, another in the series. The speaker in this series is Ramses Ghali, who is board certified in neurosurgery, anesthesia, critical care, and pain management medicine. He will talk to us about his experience in practice dealing with what neurosurgeons should know about the increase in patients on addictive drugs like ketamine, opioids, and cannabinoids in their clinical practices. He's also a clinical professor of neurosurgery, anesthesiology, neurocritical care, and pain management at a number of hospitals. He can be reached at the web address shown on this slide. There's some background information that is valuable to you, Hick, for you to know about substance abuse and addiction. Substance abuse in the United States is one of the leading health conditions which impacts millions of lives. 165 million people in the United States, it's on 60% of the people ages 12 and older currently abuse drugs, including alcohol and tobacco. 700,000 overdose deaths are recorded each year, and it's increasing at a rate of 4% per year. Like other chronic diseases of diabetes and cancer, the cost of this addiction is almost equal to the others. It includes healthcare expenses, lost earnings and income, cost of drug-related crimes, overdoses, and more. These are the common addictive drugs, marijuana, hashish, and other cannabis-related substances, some that are inhaled K2 spice bath salts, barbiturates and benzodiazepines, hypnotics can be ingested or injected, methamphetamine, cocaine, and other stimulants, gamma hydroxybutyric acid, GHB, or hallucinogens, LSD and phencyclidine. Other substances which can be used as inhalants, glue, paint thinners, correction fluid, felt tip marker fluid, gasoline, and opioid painkillers, which are most familiar to physicians, heroin, morphine, codeine, methadone, fentanyl, and oxycodone. A very brief summary of the anatomy and physiology of this disease. These toxic substances become molecules and are in the bloodstream going to the brain. They stimulate nerve cells in the midbrain, which are connected to the nucleus accumbens, which is in the floor, the third ventricle. And from there, those impulses are related to the memory circuits in the amygdala, on each side of the brain, to the hippocampus, which involves the emotional circuits, goes to the frontal areas, and from there spreads to the frontal lobes for executive function. In a normal non-addictive person, these pathways can be very pleasurable. However, in an addicted person, the pleasure that they get from the drugs is short-lived and they want more. So more of the drugs are ingested or inhaled, and this increases by plasticity the pathways along which these impulses are transmitted, and they get larger. In addition, there are changes in the biochemistry of each cell, and those are affected in more of the conditioned behavior. So we see in the end genetic, biochemical, metabolic changes, neuroplastic changes, all involved in addiction. And here are two references we will show you later, which you can copy or screenshot and save for your records. Ramses Ghali. Ramses is a neurosurgeon, a board-certified neurosurgeon. He also happens to be a board certified critical care specialist, and he is also board certified in anesthesia.
Thank you for this opportunity, but also you accepted the first letter to the editor that predicted back then in 2005 about the abuse of fentanyl and opioids. And I wrote a beautiful letter to the editor to warn against the liberal use of fentanyl and opioids. And 10 years later, or even 12, 15 years later, they start to discover this. So these drugs affects our patient as neurosurgeons. So we can start with talking what the most recent about ketamine. Ketamine is a good anesthetic drug that it introduced back in 1960s. And it has a very strong analgesic. Analgesic means that it's good for pain. So me as an anesthesiologist, if there is a burn patients and you wanted to change dressing, and the burn patients usually like a lot of skin pain, you give them ketamine. So ketamine, when you monitor the patient, is very attractive, anesthetic, and analgesic drug. The problem comes when you take that drug from the hands of the provider to the outside, the hospital, and they start to liberally use it. And this is what has been happening. And I see it happening now in ketamine, as it did happen in opioids. If you look at morphine and fentanyl, for instance, back in 1980s, late 1980s, in surgery, anesthesiologists use it frequently to provide anesthesia and to provide deep analgesia to patient. In fact, I was taught that morphine by itself and fentanyl by itself is a good anesthetic and you don't need anything else. And the problem is started with opioids when we convert from the hands in the operating room with the trained providers to make it available for the public. And this is something really I see it all the time. And as it happens in opioids and it takes 15 years to be harmful and to put regulation, I see it now happening to ketamine. Why ketamine started? Because the government went after the opioids, the fentanyl and the opioids. So now the physicians and the public wanted to see something alternative. So now they're finding the alternative is ketamine. The same like for narcotic, and instead of writing Norco or oxycodone, you can write Tramadol, for instance. So they're trying to find something that the government doesn't have regulation yet. And this is the problem. These drugs have one criteria, all of them. They're susceptible for misuse and abuse by regular. And imagine regular adults. Now imagine now the kids. For instance, the marijuana and the ketamine, they've been using it now in nightclubs. And in an age more than 12 years old, it started to use it. And it goes up to some statistics show 24 million people. And it's not just in America. It's worldwide, including in the United Kingdom. So imagine now the immature kids that started to use these drugs. Now, is these drugs harmful to them? Absolutely, it's harmful. It alters their mood. It makes their mood swings. It makes them susceptible to pain. If you take them to surgery now, we used to say in surgery, marijuana, not a big deal, just take them to surgery. And we used to do surgery as an anesthesiologist to that, and it turned out that they have serious side effects. So now they start to form guidelines to stop that. What is the side effects for innocence from marijuana or ketamine? Or this is heart attack, stroke, swings in the blood pressure. You're talking to a patient that you don't know if he understand this or not. The pain threshold is low. They require more pain medication. The blood pressure drops or the blood pressure is high. So this is all side effects. And what they found in their studies with the narcotic that we as physicians are responsible, and this is what they try to say, and why? Because they link it to the first surgeon that wrote the narcotic to this patient's like Norco or oxycodone. They decided that the first prescription, the likelihood for them to use it and abuse it in the future is high. So now we are at fault. So now we as a neurosurgeons, that we're having a patient with a spine pain. Let's take that a common daily practice case that all the neurosurgeon faces. So this patient has a severe sciatica, has a disc herniation, has severe sciatica pain. What are you going to do? The patient doesn't want surgery as a give. They don't like surgery. They've been afraid of surgery. They're afraid of anesthesia. Then it becomes a BO narcotic. From BO narcotic, epidural steroids. From epidural steroids, what we found out that some of them now, very easy. Just let me get a CBD oil. Let me get some marijuana from outside. I have patients come to my office like this. You examine them, they're always high, their mood is changing, and you don't know if you're talking to the patient or you're talking to somebody else. But now, what you see now is an open gate for misuse and abuse. And then I have to tell them, who said that these drugs are not without side effects? And I'm literally, you think that this is only for young people. I have patients 70 years old. She was high in these drugs. And finally, the kids convinced her. 10 months later, she said, I'm sick of these drugs. I am taking my drugs off. And now I have a lot of pain and I want you to help me. And gradually, when you take them, you don't want to jump to surgery to these people because now they have alterations in their cognitive function, into their memory, into the pain perceptions and all of that. So you try to go step by step with them. And then when you do the surgery and you correct the problem, then they come back normal and say, I don't know which state I was in it. So this is now what we're facing. It used to be narcotics and opioids in the operating room. It went to the intensive care unit. Now it's in the clinic. And now the pain clinic and other surgery centers and all of that, now they start to open the door to say, you know what, if you have depression, 10 minutes will give you an injection. Depression is going to go away, come back every week. So now it's becoming as very available in the clinics to use. So this is what you have. Remember the stories that when I was a resident under you for innocence, I had a patient that had seizures. And somebody told him, take more alcohol to drink more alcohol for seizures. So he keeps drinking alcohol, 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 until it turned out that these seizures is caused by the brain tumor that is now coming out of the skull. And this is what we're doing now. We have an access to palliate the pain and to cover up the real diagnosis. And now we're closing the access to what is the real treatment that is, we think as a scientific people and as a clinician is the best for these patients.
Outstanding, outstanding summary with real life experience. Obviously they get the drugs on the marketplace somewhere,
and so, the question is 100%.
Yeah, and then the question is, what's the likelihood that you can break them of this, get them off the drugs?
Yeah, very, very difficult. Once you get them to the use and the abuse, this is what it's very difficult to take them out. We know that human life is full of stress. There is no, in fact, when you talk about burnout in physicians and burnout in nurses or burnout in any employees, so this is, tells you we're in a lot of stress. And I don't know, I think this is part of our modern civilization now. We're not then simple people that grandfathers were, and we're able to buffer our stress by natural things and physical, take a walk or hike or things. Now we just swallow pills. We just swallow drugs. Some drugs to help us sleep, some drugs to help us ease. I have patients now in Xanax and I have patients in Cymbalta. So all these medications together. So now the easiest access, Dr. Osman, to a treatment, to any stress or any of this is to give them a pill. Now imagine now that you're gonna take them off it. Okay, taking off it for a day, for a week, another crisis comes. And it comes back into the real studies when patients starts to die from opioid overdose. They did a massive study in the whole world, and they found out much of them starts by a prescription, just one prescription. And this is really what you're going to see. If I test ketamine today, I have no problem to get ketamine again. Where do you get all of these drugs? Oh my God. You get it very easy now. In fact, in my church and in other churches, even the most religious people, they have pain. They go to the doctor. Now the doctor is afraid to prescribe Norco or this control because there is a lot of regulation. So what happened now with them? You do something like this. Now the patient has pain, doesn't want to go to the doctor to know what's wrong with him. He think it's just a little arthritis. Then he goes to the street. So one of them went to the street. He got a pill for Norco. It turned out that there is fentanyl in it, and the patient died. That patient never used any drugs. So now we encourage, in my opinion, the public to use this system as a runaway, as a getaway, to in order to decrease the stress or to be the first line of treatment. In my time, when you taught me under your residency, the first line of treatment is to make a diagnosis. How are you going to make a diagnosis? Insurance doesn't, many don't have insurance. The insurance is very expensive. They don't approve MRIs. If you see the hell that I go through to approve a surgery, just a micro disc, and how much paperwork I'm going to go through, and how much you're threatening the patient that insurance will not, I'd rather go to the next door neighbor and get a drug that helps the pain because my pain is bad. Then you're going to say, why don't you go to the ER? Most of the ER now, you wait for 12, 15 hours in order to get something. And then you'll be lucky if you get a CAT scan or an MRI. So now that, and then you get the bill at home for $30,000 to $40,000. So you tell me, if I'm a regular person, a labor, have a lot of pain, what is my options? And this is really the issue. The drugs becomes very easy. And if it is easy, I'm going to get used to it, abuse it and misuse it, and I have it in my cabinet. And this is the scary one.
Outstanding explanation. Why don't we go to, like, can we skip to, we can come back to this, skip to meth and to THC. You can explain that to the audience because these are some others. And tell us a little bit about where they come from, what they are, and what their effects are.
Okay, so this is a plant that actually literature supports that was discovered in China 2,800 years ago, and it's called cannabis, and one of the substance in it is the tetrahydrocannabinoids. Is a plant equal to another plant called the stevia, and the other one is called ginseng, and this marijuana. Which is forms this plant. It has a male and a female, and it has substances in it or ingredients in it. Some of them makes you high, and this is really the catch of this marijuana drug. It makes people high, and it found out there's a lot of receptors that works with this, which is in the memory, in the brain, in the pain receptors.
So let me interrupt you a second. You said it makes you high. For our friends who are in the watching this in another country, what does high mean into?
It's a state of mind that is euphoric. It's an euphoric. You feel elated. You feel very happy. You feel you're out of space. Some people think for innocence in this substance, you feel near this experience. It takes you somewhere else. It covers your drama, your miseries. If you have a lot of stress in your life, it takes you away. So it's a high state. And that euphoric state is what makes it the addiction, and the use and abuse. I wanted to feel high. I wanted to go to get some of this, and you can smoke it in the streets. This is what is high means. And this is also, you see it in opioids, like fentanyl and all of that. This is the word high is common in all the abusive drugs like cocaine, for instance. And it's interesting that once you take one, you mix it with another. So ketamine goes with cocaine, it goes with alcohol, and it becomes a vicious cycle. You try all of this. And they found that this is what we see now, and we see it at the age of 12 years old. In
Wow.
fact, there is in nightclubs, so they call the ketamine, for instance, vitamin K. And imagine now, if you wanted to rape people, you can actually give them mixtures of this. They become elated in a different mood, different stage, and you can rape them. And this is where all these issues happening. People are trying to continue to find places that take them from reality and from the stress where they are, and we make it easy for them.
Wow. If you're on fentanyl, or if you're on ketamine, do you still get a high with that?
Of course. And the most dangerous is fentanyl is the most potent, because you innocently stop breathing and you die. And in anesthesia, we have seen it repeatedly now, and it's becoming a dangerous observation. We lost residents to this because you have an access to these drugs as an anesthesiologist. And in fact, they found out if a resident using this, a 40% chance, even if you take him for a year or two, to all of this programs, rehabilitation program, they come back into this addiction with a high mortality. So this is really the issue, the side effects of these drugs that is becoming a serious. If you take ketamine for innocence or marijuana, you have a high, you expose yourself to heart attack, to high blood pressure, to a stroke. And this is what we tell the patients. In fact, some of the new guidelines that we try to pursue, which I do, in my practice, even in the office here, even in people that they look to you like you think they don't use it, I just tell them, do you use ketamine? Do you use street drugs? Do you use marijuana and all of this? And you'll be surprised. Many of them said, yeah, I'm using drugs. I have patients that, like really patients that are well educated, they use marijuana every day, and they for 25 years. What are you going to do with them? You can't. You have to think three times before you do surgery if you find a disc herniation in them, because you're going to end up by major problems, anesthetic wise complications as well as pain management.
Well, let's go into that for a minute, because you see this. You're unique, because not only you see it as a neurosurgeon who's taking care of a person who has an organic disease, a pain, a disc or something that's causing pain. You see it in the intensive care unit, because some of these people come in there acutely ill, I'm sure, and they want to call you to consult you. You see it in anesthesia, because you have to deal with it on the other side of the drapes.
Yes.
How does this make surgery more complicated?
Extremely complicated, extremely. Because first, you have to see if they actually can subject themselves to the risks of anesthesia. But one of the important things that we discover, they require so much anesthetics, so much drugs during anesthesia, analgesic-wise. In recovery, they usually scream of pain. A normal person after this surgery does not scream of pain, they scream of pain. So what usually happens, Dr. Osman, is you give them more narcotic, and they get arrested from breathing. And everyone is trying very hard to put the Joint Commission and the government, as it has nothing to do with the abuse of opioids, for instance. But it's actually, to me, I witness it. When you they said pain is another vitals that you must take. So if you go to the hospitals in 2005 and afterward, you ask it the pain, and what is the pain score? If you write that the pain score is 10, and this is what your patient is going to tell you, the same that the patient walk in your office and you know that they exaggerating and you have to th they have red flag, you tell them, what's your brain score? 10. Now, if you're in a clinic and you have brain 10 and you look at the MRI and you say there is no large disc herniation, this is in itself red flag. Now you need to think what is causing all of this, whether there is drugs in it. And why is that? Because you're obligated to go, why this person is different. If you end by doing surgery be just because of the pain, then you end by a very bad prognosis. Because what happened in these patients, and you saw it and I saw it, once you marry these patients and you do surgery, you're going to have to start to write the drugs to this patient. Why? We have seen it a lot. Because that patient will come and threaten you and tell you, you know, you mismanage me this. He gives the hell to your staff and you're afraid that he's going to sue you and all of this. So you marry a patient like this is a nightmare. In recovery, when they wake up from surgery, first, you have to ask, do they really need this extensive surgery? Is this really a good indication to subject a patient like this with surgery? And then you say, okay, so we did it. And the surgeon nowadays, as you know, they don't see the patients often. They let other people see the patients for them. So he does the surgery and you get stuck with this in recovery. So now what we do for them, we cannot give them a lot of narcotics. So we try as a hospital to get some sort of protocol. Most of the time it ends by giving him something else other than opioids to try not to suppress their breathing. So they start to develop, you have to put them in entitled CO2, you have to put them in a telebed, you have to go and increase the observation and the supervision in these patients. And many times we end by putting them in the ICU under ketamine infusion. And then for the next 3, 4 days, you need to start to wean this medication off. And then you replace it with a stronger, long-acting opioids. So if you do cases like this, it's non-win-win.
Yeah, it's incredible. Is the it looks like from what you're telling me, is that the final common pathway is respiratory death. Is that am I right or am I wrong?
Yeah. So it's several things. For the opioids, 100%, 100%. Respiratory arrest. And a lot of them, they don't realize it. This is the sad and the scary part. You take fentanyl, you think you're high, you think you're with it, and but you don't breathe. So they don't perceive that they actually cannot breathe. They don't breathe. They don't want to breathe. So they become hypoxic. So if you watch the narcotic and when you give narcotic, we breathe about 20 per minute. They will breathe 7 per minute. And if you give them more, they start not breathe. And the next thing you know, it's a desaturation, hypoxemia, the heart stops, the brain stops, and now you have a cardiac arrest. And the sad part, Dr. Aldred, Dr. Osman, you will see it in most of the cases. And here is the common scenario that I see it. The nurse gives 0.2 milligram dilaudid or 0.3 or sometimes one because this is what the protocol said. Turn her back and leave. Next thing is a code blue. This is how fast because you give it intravenous. And I have developed in my practice so many guards to prevent this. And I teach the patient, I said, it's okay to have pain, but is you have the right to say, I don't want you to inject me with intravenous medication. I just need a bell. Or I commonly use now ice packs. So we call it multimodal to prevent this. So this is one cause of death, which is common for opioids, for fentanyls. And this is number one reason why the entire world got mad and the government got mad for narcotic abuse. Okay, so this is one. From ketamine and other drugs is something else. It's no protection. Is the patient is not him anymore. Is not himself. Like Barry Matthew, for instance, he didn't know that he's in the bathroom, for instance. So you sink, you drown, you don't have good judgment. Your cognitive function is not with it. Your self-protective measures is not with it. So you can do things to change. And you don't have to go far. I don't know the name, but just recently, a month ago, the famous singer in Argentina, found in a hotel, dead and mutilated, traumatized. This has just happened now. And why? Because they found out that he was on high drugs, the same drugs, and then he jumped and he hurt himself and he didn't know. So the important part about the cause of death here, you're not protecting yourself. You're not yourself anymore. And if this is the message that I wanted to give to all the neurosurgeons and all of them, be very careful. You must ask what drugs they use. Do not operate in patients and drugs. You have to clear them from this because they're not who they are. And ultimately, you're going to pay the price because you're the physicians of that patient. Imagine now that you have a patient that takes morphine as a baseline. You do spine fusion. How long are you going to give them this high dose of narcotics at home? And who's going to monitor him at home? And then if you say, you know what, I cannot give you more, then he's going to be mad from you. So this is a dangerous time where we live in. And guess what? From opioids, now we're opening ketamine. And ketamine, they got another drug called esketamine. Imagine now, what is the next drug you're going to give it? Because we're humans. We're going to develop more, and we have an industry that is hungry for money. And this is what's going to happen. How much money this is, drugs is? $50,000 plus a month when one person used to get ketamine? You know what I mean? Imagine marijuana. Imagine mix it up with other drugs. And you don't know what they mix it with.
Amazing. Well, so it almost seems like a point of no return. I can see the patient comes in, he comes back, he's got tremendous pain. And do you operate on him? You don't operate on him? How do you deal with that? And some doctors are, they don't have a lot of colleagues or other people in their community to refer him to. I'm sure one thing is, because I saw this in practice, doctors, and there are some specialties that do that, just stop seeing the patient after surgery and refer him to an internist or something that he settled with the problem.
Yeah, and actually the primary physician doesn't take care of them anymore because they're afraid of the federal government. So now they send it to pain clinic, and you and me know the pain clinic. And here's what the pain clinic will do, because I also certified in pain as well. So what they do, they'll start to justify injections. So now you did a spine fusion. Now they're getting medication. They're going to get also all kind of injections and all kind of explanation of their pain that you as a surgeon have no control in. So now from having a patient that you enjoy good outcome and you under your control and you manage him, now you have a different people controlling him, managing him, and unfortunately, I hate to say it, feed into his complaint.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So it's really, really, really tough. It's a very tough problem. And what you always taught us is the patient is a whole. You have to know everything about the patient, take care about the patient. Nobody else is going to take care of this patient better than you. So you sit and you direct. We as neurosurgeons and as physicians, we are physicians before neurosurgeons, and we have the opportunity. And this is what I do in my practice all the time. I tell them, I will listen to you, and this is what I do. And it's been working great. Based on your complaint of pain 10 out of 10, of legs that is paralyzed, of all of this, I'm going to get an MRI. A patient that complained like this, I must see something in the MRI in order for me to help and in order for me to match both of them. If I don't see it, then we're talking about something else. I care less about the insurance pay the money. I do now, Dr. Osman, I do MRI the first thing. And you know what? I found facilities, the MRI is $400. I tell the patient, you know, I'm not going to wait for the insurance to pay for you. It's the plumber when it comes to your home. It comes for $400. So might as well just do MRI. You'll have a peace of mind what you have. And I found this helpful. If he has a disc and there is a problem, I'm okay. Then I go take him to the routes We're going to do an end point. This is the end point. Therapy, Iceman, this is, and I try to minimize the pain medication. If I don't see that, then the patient himself starts to feel sorry for himself because I tell him, I don't know where this pain is because you made me order this MRI for you. I try to find the problem. There is no. So this is called functional problem. So this is how it helps me. But I will not, I'm one of the surgeon, I will not do surgery unless I get to the bottom of this drug history and I make sure that the patient is not addicted, is not abusing, and is not misusing.
Wow, that's just a terrific quick overview of this. Just a horrendous, a difficult problem, really difficult, and it's worldwide.
Yes. In your time, when you were a surgeon and you taught us, we don't mess with this. If you have a problem and I can fix, I'll fix it. The patient will love you and say, thank you, doc. I want you to fix me. Now, it's really different. You know, I tell him the difference between America and the remote area in Africa, big difference. In America, I am here to help you fix the problem you don't want. In the remote area in Africa, they don't have me. And so they don't do the surgery. So America now and the world civilized countries now is becoming like the remote country in Africa that we think we're better than them. And actually we're not. Because they're no longer looking at fixing a problem. My standard patients, Dr. Osman, I see now is a patient that has been in hell of pain and suffering for 15 to 20 years, swallowing tramadol and drugs. And this is what they do. And the minute I see them, I say, you're here. What the drugs have done to you? It made you a different person. You're not even feeling any improvement because you need to swallow more medication. And we do, you go to the job, your brain is not with you as sharp as you should be. And now let's prevent this. So I start to wean them off. And you need to find support people, support medical providers that believe in this because you have medical providers that they have liberal use of this medication. So you have to be careful in your practice. The hospitals now, Dr. Osman, without interrupting you, they're seeing the uprise of this. So they start to develop something called enhanced recovery. This is you arrest. You're going to see that everything is arrest. I'm serious. Arrest and pituitary tumor. I review an article, arrest of pituitary tumor. I said, well, the arrest that you wrote is what a regular neurosurgeon should do, but you just put the word arrest. So now they're trying to find arrest for people coming with a spine surgeon that does surgery in addictive drugs. How are we going to handle them in the hospital for 5, 6 days and ketamine and subjecting the liability to the hospital and staff?
So you said, I was trying to understand what you said. You said a risk or arrest?
No, the risk of having this patient in the hospital.
So everybody categorizes them, says these people are now a different risk. Is that what you're saying?
100%, 100%. The risk of dying from sleep, from this is, there is an abuse and hostility to the staff. They can jump and it becomes a fall and it becomes reported in the Joint Commission, all of that. So it's a lot of liability to the hospitals and to the individual. How can they write a good patient satisfaction that the measures of the hospital if you're not going to give them the drugs they want?
So it now boils down to once it starts out with the patient's problem, it winds up being the hospital and the doctor's problem from possible suit and malpractice.
Yes. Oh, 100%. We have seen it, not just me, many, that we become a hostage with such a patient.
Oh.
If I ever regret, I probably will regret about 2, 3 patients in early of my career that I felt I'm marrying them for the next 2 years because they've been threatening. And it's a hostage. I just call it, you marry them. You do surgery, you marry them. And actually we know, and if you want to marry somebody, You really need to marry somebody that is not going to put you in trouble.
Well, terrifically practical explanation, Rams. It's just wonderful. You got a background in neurosurgery and pain and critical care and anesthesia. I mean,
And
some
I
of these animals.
you have to take a lot of credit, Dr. Osman. You're the chairman that supported me with all of that. I still remember I used to do when I did anesthesia, I was doing anesthesia attending in one hospital. I was in the neuro ICU. I start to implement some of the drugs like the propofol and things like that. So it becomes complementary. And I wrote it in some of my books, though, because at that time many people said, "You're crazy. You're crazy." Now, I'm a person with a good Christian faith. So I just love what I do. And then only years later, Dr. Osman, which is now that I found why God allowed me to this and how God allow you to be in my path. Because now it's everything is fragmented. So I'm gonna give you an example. When a patient comes with a disc herniation, sometimes if I don't see a large disc or I see some neurologic deficit, I do an injection for anesthesia. During the injection, I'm testing them. I'm also evaluating them. If this patient overreacting when I put a needle or is fainting, I need to think more about this patient first before I jump to surgery. So you start to get this. And if you wait for anesthesia to clear the patient for you, you know what is happening now in the hospitals? The anesthesiologist see the patient 5 minutes before the surgery. So what is the anesthesiologist in my time and your time? See the patients beforehand, night before. Now they don't. Only the nurse practitioner, and you look through the Epic system or the Cerner, the records to see what they have. So imagine now, for me, I bring up the patients, I work the patient up, I make sure they can fit surgery. Because who's going to do this otherwise? Now you're going to talk to a primary physician. You know what they do now, Dr. Osman? I don't know if you're aware. Now they don't clear the patient. In my time, they clear, but they found that they're legally problem. So they say optimization. This is a word. But then the second thing is say, I'm going to clear the patient for you, but it's a high risk. Oh my God, what does this to mean to a neurosurgeon? What do you mean by high risk? You know what I mean? So it's not like the old days. Now I work them up. I wanted to know their ejection fraction. I wanted to know their kidney function. I know now what patients I can take them to surgery now. A regular neurosurgeon now is minimally invasive. It stays in the OR and that's it. I feel bad for them. But for my patients, I'm pain. I'm an anesthesiologist. I'm a neurosurgeon because nowadays everything is very fragmented. So I feel I add more to that.
Well, good. This has been a terrific session. So we're going to have you back in the future talking about what neurosurgeons need to know about anesthesia for their patients, right?
Yeah,
And
perfect.
then
Yeah.
the practical things they need to know about critical care, because obviously it differs across the world. Some people don't have critical care, some have minimal, and some have very extensive, some have critical care run by other people. So those are some things we're going to talk about. Is there something else that we left out?
No, I just wanted to tell the audience in particular, it's very important to be like Dr. Osman and the professors, our fathers. You have to know about your patients from beginning to the end. It's your patient. Once you advocate or you commit yourself to cut this patient to do the surgery, it's your patient. You must know what the anesthesiologists do, what is the drugs available. So this is a very important. Plus, we as neurosurgeons, we have the trust of patients. So we are in a situation or role that we can make a big difference and it changes the lives.
And it's very complicated now because things are so subspecialized or super specialized that the anesthesiologists do what you say. They see them, everybody else, and the doctor is further and further away from the patient.
Yeah, and one of the things that I you can ask, you can just ask in the journal as a question, how many neurosurgeons wait in the operating room for neuro assessment for the patients to wake up from surgery and assist them before they leave the operating room. I am so surprised when I see my colleagues as just, they don't. They say, oh, he's just still under anesthesia and no exam for these patients. There's a lot of principles that we have changed. And this is, comes to the point when we discuss next time, how important for the surgeon to know the anesthetic used and how important to do neuro assessment before you leave the operating room. And ultimately, many hospitals will let the neurosurgeon take care of that patient post-operative.
Wow.
So ultimately, you're responsible.
Well, Ramses, I want to thank you. I think you did a superb job. It was just a great explanation. And
thank you for inviting me.
It's a huge problem. And you've even made it bigger because it's almost impossible for the doctor to manage this with all the forces he has to deal with, but you gave them some tips along the way. And that's good. Okay, thank you very much. And these are the references for Dr. Ghali's talk. Take screenshots of each page and save them for your records. This is the first set of four resources you can use. The web addresses for each one of them are given. They're associated with foundations in San Francisco, National Institute of Drug Abuse, pain medicine, and anesthesiology sites. If you look at those, you can find a lot of information on what he discussed. There are several references here which would be also of value. And Dr. Ghali recommends, if you're interested in ketamine, there are two references on ketamine. And there is a third reference on marijuana, which can be available from a government source. If you go to the web address there, you will find that you can get that and download that free. Another subject Dr. Ghali discusses is enhanced recovery after surgery, known as ERAS, ERAS. And this study done by Dr. Porsche and Associates on spine surgery patients shows that you can enhance the recovery after surgery by and return their physiologic function in patients who appear to be frail or undergoing surgery with early ambulation and early enhanced recovery after surgery. Very good reference to read. Conclusions are, to his paper, enhanced recovery after surgery or early ambulation strategies significantly improve return of physiologic function, length of stay in patients, even if they're frail. And that is compared to those patients who are not frail. And this is the slide I told you I would show you on the genetic, biochemical, metabolic, and neuroplastic changes involved in addictions. There are two references here. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit. Go to the home page and you can look in the Rate This scale underneath the video and rate this program. It will help us improve our future programming. The recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send comments or questions or request for CME to Ausman at snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. SNI, or Surgical Neurology International, is a 2D journal. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is a 3D video journal. Both are free 24/7, 365 on the internet. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories since 2010, is the third largest readership in the world. And SNI Digital has just been published for 8 months and is already in 141 countries. Foundation supporting these programs is interested in helping people throughout the world. It also has a television network, medical news network, with the purpose of bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. This is information that's all copyrighted by the James I. and Carolyn R. Hausman Educational Foundation. It's an IRS USA 501c3 operating foundation. All rights are reserved. We hope you enjoyed this program. Thank you very much for watching it.